A year ago, next Friday, Continental Flight 3407 crashed outside of Buffalo, New York, killing all 49 people on board and one on the ground. Although the airplane was painted with the Continental logo, it was actually operated by Colgan Air, a regional airline that also flies routes under contract for United and U.S. Airways. A Frontline documentary called Flying Cheap looks into how these regional carriers have changed the airline industry and how these changes affect the safety of passengers. It airs locally tomorrow at 9 p.m. And joining me now is Frontline correspondent Miles O'Brien. Welcome to our show.
Leonard, good to talk to you again.
Wasn't the National Transportation Safety Board scheduled to issue a report on the crash last week?
It did come out last week, and they placed the blame squarely on the cockpit crew, on the pilot, saying it was pilot error. And when you read the cockpit voice recorder transcript and when you look what happened with the flight data recorder, it is clearly a case of pilot error. There is no question that they were not paying attention to their instruments. They allowed that aircraft to inexplicably lose speed, stall, and their reaction to the stall was precisely the opposite of what it should have been. And so on the surface, you say, oh, pilot error. But what we wanted to find out was what led to that terrible case of pilots not doing the right job. And we found it has very, very deep roots.
Well, you say that they actually pulled on the controls instead of pushed on them or allowed the plane to automatically do that. That would sound like they had no idea of how to fly a plane.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I'm a pilot, and I own a small airplane, and in about the third lesson when you learn how to fly, they teach you that when the plane stalls, you apply full power and you push the nose over. It's like aviation 101. What the NTSB said, and which I think jives with what was going on, was it was a startled reflex, almost instinctual reaction. Much of what we learn in flying is to overcome our instinct. The natural reaction is if you're going down to pull back because that puts the nose up. But putting the nose up just made it lose more airspeed, put it into a stall, and then ultimately a spin. So what was going on in that cockpit prior to that is what is most telling. They were tired. The first officer was sick and flying sick because she felt apparently that she couldn't afford to check into a hotel room and not fly the flight. And they were talking about company business and the difficulties of flying that regional airline job when they should have been looking at their gauges.
How did the airline explain what caused the crash?
Well, it's always easy for airlines to blame the cockpit crew. It limits the discussion, limits the liability. When we tried to talk to the airline about this documentary and about some of the root causes of all this, the way these pilots are paid and the fatigue issues and the work rules, when we tried to go to the airlines and get an answer from them, they shut us down. We did speak to the head of the Regional Airline Association, who said basically, you know, we're all about safety, and this is one level of safety with the major airlines. But what we found in our investigation is, yes, there is one set of rules for airlines, large and small, but in the case of the smaller players, they are right at the bare minimums of those rules, where the big guys, they're going above and beyond it. And the problem is, when you and I get on that flight to Buffalo, you're going to see the logo of one of the big players there, Continental or United or whatever the case may be. You really have to pay attention to the fine print to realize that that flying has been outsourced to a smaller carrier. In this case, it was Colgan.
Now, it's my sense that we've seen fewer plane crashes in recent years, at least in this country. So is this really a problem?
Well, you know, yeah, I mean, let's face it. This is the safest form of transportation that human beings have devised since we came up with the wheel. There's no question this is safe in every respect. What we found and what is troubling, I think, is we have an expectation of a certain level of safety when we get on these airlines, and we may not be getting what we pay for. We assume when we buy a ticket that says Continental on it that Continental Airlines, one way or another, is responsible for the safety, for setting the work rules, for hiring and firing. In this case, that Continental painted plane and that Continental logo, the mainline, Continental, had nothing to do with the operations of that aircraft. They pay on a contract basis for these smaller carriers to deliver people from point A to point B, fly the segments, and beyond that, they have very little say-so about how those operations are run. It's like having a farm team, but the major league team is not paying any attention to how the players are treated.
Now, they pay for the completion of the flight. They don't pay per passenger.
That's right.
Now, why is that significant?
Well, if you think about it for a minute, everything about the way these contracts are structured is about getting that airplane, moving the equipment, or as the pilots would tell you, pushing the aircraft around. And so what they end up doing is they're in situations where if there is a situation with a mechanical or there's a weather problem, there is every disincentive toward doing the safe thing, which in some cases is not to fly the flight or in some cases to divert. That goes for the company, and it also goes for the flight crew as well, because the flight crew, they are legally allowed to fly, have a 16-hour duty day. Legally, they are allowed to fly 8 hours of that time. They are only paid for the time when they're in that airplane moving passengers. And so when they're in a situation where, for whatever reason, things may not be perfect for that flight or not as safe as they want it to be, the incentive for them is to fly the flight anyway. So the system is built around completion of segments when really there should be some way to reward safety.
I'm reminded of a situation I was in some years back where I wanted to go to Washington. There was a major snowstorm, and pretty much all the flights had been canceled, and I just went from airline to airline to find out if I could find a plane. I finally did. We got to Washington. But in retrospect, after seeing this film, I was making the wrong decision, wasn't I?
Well, maybe so, But, think about it. As a passenger, you and I get on that plane, and we presume that we're getting a level of safety that we would associate with that brand. The true fact of the matter is that, McDonald's corporate tells their franchisees more about how to cook their French fries than Continental tells Colgan how to fly their airplanes. So it's a very interesting system, and part of it is set up with the notion and the idea that the liability in these cases is separate. So if Colgan crashes at Buffalo, as it did a year ago, the liability is squarely on Colgan and does not go back to the mainline carrier, Continental, in this case.
But isn't it in Colgan's best interest to train their flight crews properly? After all, even those smaller planes are quite expensive, aren't they? And then you have all the bad publicity and everything else that follows.
Well, there's nothing good about having a crash. There's no question about that. And nobody would tell you that I made a decision today that caused a crash. It's a lot of little incremental decisions that are baked into the system, a system that is under tremendous pressure that, let's face it, we read the headlines. We know how the airline business does in general. Since it began, it's never made a nickel. It's a very, very hard way to make money, and it's under tremendous cost pressure. And so all these little decisions that are made are what add up to a level of safety that you wouldn't necessarily anticipate. And yes, it would be nice if they were to go above and beyond the FAA minimums as the big carriers do, but they don't because they're in a tremendously competitive business and they'll just be underbid by somebody else when that contract comes due. And so they do the bare minimum FAA regulations. So the real question we should all be asking is, why doesn't the FAA stand in there or get in there and raise that bar of safety a little bit so even the bare minimum is a little bit better? So it addresses these fatigue issues. It addresses these pilot pay and commuting issues. That is something that we should press the FAA on. And this accident in Buffalo a year ago might be precipitate some of those changes.
My guest is Miles O'Brien, whose frontline documentary called Flying Cheap airs tomorrow at 9 p.m. locally on Channel 13. Were you able to speak with anyone from the FAA?
We did speak with the administrator, Randy Babbitt, and he is an interesting guy. He has come in as a change agent. He is a veteran airline pilot, spent some time at the Airline Pilots Union, and now comes to the FAA with a background in the mainline carriers. And he is vowing to make some changes, to work on this issue on these fatigue rules, which are very antiquated and don't address the fact that, you know, a night shift is different from a day shift, for example. And the work rules for a night shift should not be the same as for a day shift because of circadian rhythms. We know intuitively now and scientifically as well that people are not as alert. And so they're looking into all these things, but things move slowly at the Federal Aviation Administration. Like all of our government agencies, there's a whole period of rule change and comment, and there's a lot of pressure that is brought to bear on them by the various lobbying interests and the airlines who are naturally concerned about their bottom line.
Well, how much training must a pilot for a major airline have before he can be called captain or she?
Well, just to get into that first officer's seat, the right seat on a mainline carrier, you have to have what's called an air transport license, which is a minimum of 1,500 hours of experience. So the big players won't even talk to anybody who has that minimum of 1,500 hours of experience. At the regional level, the minimum is 250 hours. And what we have found is...
pilots have 500 hours in many cases, you point out.
Yes, yes. 250, 500 hours is very common as the captain. So, you know, we all, I think intuitively, we understand that, you know, there is an apprentice period for pilots. And I think we all know that there's this, you know, there's going to be people who are new to the game who are going to be flying you. But what I always thought as an educated traveler and pilot myself is that there was a Sully next to the new first officer who was mentoring this younger apprentice. That is not the case. What we found is the nature of these airlines are such that they're hiring people with the minimum of experience, and the captain sitting beside the person with the minimum of experience is just slightly ahead of he or she. So what you have is an experience deficit in many of these cockpits, and that's what we saw a year ago, frankly, in Buffalo.
Is this a way of getting around paying union wages for the flight crew?
Well, this is frankly how it all got started, because the airlines were, you know, bound by their union agreements, and these legacy carriers have, you know, deep history with the union agreements and paid their pilots very handsomely, as we all well know. Now, those contracts have been whittled away over time, but the truth is this was a way of circumventing those contracts by subcontracting these flights out. They would go to the unions and say, look, we'll let you keep your salary, but we want you to give up the Newark to Buffalo route, and we're going to give that to an outsourced carrier that is non-union and pays its different set of wages and has a different set of rules. So that is the actual root of how this began.
And then there are the other changes, more deregulation, the concentration on hubs at airports. But I'm not sure I understand how they can put the logo of Continental or Delta or US Air on an airplane that isn't theirs.
Well, this is the thing, and you know, you could make a case that this is a little bit of a bait and switch, that we think we're buying Continental ticket when it's not. Now, what the Regional Airline Association will tell you, what the airlines will tell you, is, well, look, you know, just read your ticket, and in the fine print down there, it'll say operated by such and such, Colgan Airways, or whatever the case may be. But let's face it, most people don't really understand what that means. They assume if it's Continental on the tail and the Continental colors, that they're getting Continental-level service and standards, but that's not what happens.
What percentage of flights that take place in the U.S. today are being run by these smaller carriers?
It just went over 50%. It's right around 50-51%. So slowly but surely, and this is something, as you point out, it really began with deregulation in 1978 as that hub-and-spoke system came in, and, you know, these very competitive players like Southwest came in, put pressure on these airlines. They were forced to look at ways to compete. How do they do it? So this is one of the ways within the hub-and-spoke context. They wanted to keep their long, more profitable routes intact and fly those themselves and look at the shorter routes, which were not as profitable, and go to outsourcing to come up with a way to deliver those people to their hubs. And so, you know, some would say, hey, maybe we should go back to re-regulation. I'm not sure that's the solution, but this is already a very regulated industry. To call it deregulated, I guess, it's kind of in a gray area.
So should I assume that any short-haul flight will be on a regional, any flight that has a propeller on the wing?
Well, almost always, yeah. There are some cases, for example, American Eagle. American Airlines Holding Company, AMR, owns American Eagle. And they actually do have a little higher set of standards for that regional airline. And it is because it is actually owned by the legacy carrier. But by and large, what you're running into are these regional players, these companies that are smaller, that grow, that many of them grew out of the air charter operations, as Colgan did out of Manassas, Virginia, flying typical charter operations that evolved into these short hop airlines that got these flying contracts with the big players. They call it code sharing. The idea is the code of the ticket stays the same. You buy the ticket from Buffalo all the way to Paris, and it's continental the whole way, and it makes it easier for you to transfer bags, and you buy one ticket, and you check in at one place, and all those things add a level of convenience for consumers, there's no question. But if you're not paying attention, you really don't know who is flying you along the way.
Isn't it the same sort of thing that they're doing with majors? For example, American Airlines would have a deal with Japan Airlines?
Yeah, you know, what the irony to that, though, is when American Airlines cuts a deal to code share with Japan Airlines, that airline has to go out and has to do a careful inspection of how that airline, how Japan Airlines does business. What kind of training does it have? What kind of safety programs does it have? The FAA forces American carriers to do this because those overseas carriers are outside of FAA jurisdiction. The American Airlines, if it goes to Colgan and tries to do business with it, doesn't even have to ask any questions about safety or how it does business because it is presumed, because it is under the FAA rules, that it is flying to the standard. Well, they do fly to the standard, but the standard is the question. Is the standard enough? Is that minimum standard something that needs to be upped?
My guest is Miles O'Brien, who is not only a pilot, but he's also a frontline correspondent. And the documentary that he is reporting that we're discussing is called Flying Cheap. It airs tomorrow at 9 p.m. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Miles O'Brien, who is the frontline correspondent on Flying Cheap, which airs tomorrow at 9 p.m. here on Channel 13, and I assume will be at different times around the country. You talked to on camera with a number of former pilots for regional airlines, including some who work for Colgan Air. What did they tell you?
Well, they told me a story which scared me, quite frankly, Leonard. These guys felt a tremendous amount of pressure all the way around. Nobody forces them to become pilots. Obviously, this is a dream they all had to one day be flying big jet airliners across the ocean or whatever the case may be. And this was seen as the way to get in to the business.
But now, Miles, can I stop for you for just
yeah.
a moment? I always thought that what happened is people flew for the Air Force or some other military arm. And then when they retired from the military, they wound up becoming the pilots of these jetliners.
Yeah, it's kind of the Sullenberger route, which was, you know, frankly, if you really think about it, Leonard, for years and years, the government essentially subsidized the training of pilots for the airlines by putting people through the military, training so many pilots in a very effective way, a way that far exceeds what you get in any sort of civilian training program. And then those pilots, after they did their time with the military, would be turned over and would move into the airlines, and the airlines would have these fantastically trained people that just kind of landed on their doorstep. What has happened in recent years is a couple of things. First of all, there's many fewer cockpits out there as the military has shrunk the size of its piloted aircraft. You'll note we spend a lot of time talking about unmanned drones that are doing a lot of the missions these days. There are fewer and fewer cockpits. The F-22, the next generation Air Force fighter, has been drastically reduced in numbers. So there are fewer and fewer of these pilots that exist in the first place. And secondly, the military is doing a better job hanging on to them. It costs millions of dollars to train these people, and so they end up staying in the military. Number one, they get paid well there. The military tries to keep them, and they look at the airline business and all the upheaval in it, and they don't see a very attractive alternative. So we're getting many fewer Sullys are being produced. And so what we get these days are people who go to these places. We went to a place down in Florida called the Gulfstream Training Academy. And what they do there is you come down there and you plunk your $30,000 on the barrel head, and they put you through a training program. And part of your training is you pay for the privilege of sitting in the co-pilot seat of an airline they actually run to the Bahamas. So you fly to the Bahamas on this Gulfstream airline, it's very likely the co-pilot isn't being paid, but rather is paying to be there. So there's obviously an inherent conflict of interest there. If somebody isn't cutting the mustard as a pilot, and they're paying these training companies to get them through, are they going to wash them out? No, they're going to do their best to keep them in there and push them through the program and get them into the system. And so what that does is over time it really reduces the quality of the pilots that are being presented to these airlines.
And what did the pilots tell you? Did they think that the safety standards maintained by the companies they work for are adequate?
Well, no. I heard stories of pilots who were in situations where they had mechanical problems that were not necessarily problems that you could limp home. In other words, they would tell them, "Look, if you're at this remote station, and you couldn't you possibly fly back without that collision avoidance system? Because we'd rather have it back here at home, where it's easier and cheaper for us to fix it." We've heard of situations. We had a pilot who told us a really just blood-curdling story about being at LaGuardia Airport and having a very full flight headed to Ithaca. He did his mathematics on the weight and balance figures for the aircraft, and he told his captain that this airplane is too heavy to take off on the conditions that presented themselves that day. The captain said, "Well, why don't you turn three of the adults into infants for the paperwork?" In other words, do some pencil whipping to make that manifest look proper. The first officer said, "I'm not going to do that." The captain took the piece of paper, said, "I'll take care of it." And later, it was discovered he had falsified that document. Well, what was really, that was bad enough. The first officer complained about it to the FAA. It got to an adjudicative process. The captain basically admitted what happened and was at the forum where he was losing his license. The airline, Colgan, showed up and testified on behalf of the captain. So what the first officer concluded after that, he left the airline, was that this was not a company that put safety first. He was putting safety first, and he was painted as the villain in the company's eyes.
Now, Colgan is the airline that was involved with the crash in Buffalo last year. Are they the worst example here?
Well, they certainly are among the lowest paying of the regional airlines. That's one way to quantify it, I suppose. Just in talking to the pilots, they tell us some stories which would lead us to believe that that maybe safety isn't their uppermost concern, that they are pushing that equipment as best they can, moving that equipment around, because that is, in effect, how they stay in business. So, it's difficult for me to say they're the worst player. We didn't do an exhaustive study of every regional out there. But just in talking to the pilots, the recent departees, and of course we spoke to many current pilots who couldn't come forward on camera, they have all told us that this is a story that needed to be told, and they were very anxious to make sure it got out there one way or another.
I'm sure they don't want to die in a plane crash either.
Well, they're the first one to arrive at the scene of the crash, aren't they?
James from NIAC left a comment on our show page. He wants to know, what's the starting salary for first officers and captains who fly for these regionals?
Well, the starting salary as a first officer coming in is, at Colgan at least, and this is pretty much industry standard, hovers around $20,000, a little less in some cases. The first officer involved in the Buffalo flight a year ago, Rebecca Shaw was making something less than $20,000 a year. She was living in Seattle with her parents because she was assigned the Newark base as her home base. I mean, you know, imagine living where we live in New York on that kind of money. You can't live a very good life at $18,000 or $20,000. That's a poverty wage. And so she lived at home in Seattle, and prior to signing in for her flight a year ago, had flown all the way across the country overnight, made her way to the pilot's lounge at Newark, and tried to catch some rest just in a reclining chair there in the pilot lounge. So that was the day prior to her sign-in, her last sign-in, and all the while she was ill and talked about on the cockpit voice recorder that she was reluctant to check into a hotel, A, because of the cost of the hotel, and B, she would lose whatever pay she would get for that trip. So the pressure there not to sign in sick is something that people talked about frequently as well.
And in the film, you show what looks like a flop house or a jammed dormitory at a ski lodge where a lot of different beds are available, where these people where the pilots just can rent a bed for the night.
Yeah, it's the unfortunate term for these places, given the context of what we're talking about. The unfortunate term is crash pad. They call them crash pads. Frankly, it looked to me, what it made me think of, because they're triple and sometimes quadruple bunks stacked up, it looks like being on a submarine. And basically, people go in and they get a one-bedroom apartment in these high-expense bases. They get a one-bedroom apartment and they put, you know, six or eight people share the rent, and that gives them a place to go and hang their hat before and after their sign-ins for trips. We heard of people renting literally a closet, renting space on a couch or in these triple bunks. And you say, you know, when you get on these flights on an early morning flight, that's very likely some of the people who are flying that plane, it's very likely they spent the night before on one of these crash pads. And you have to wonder how restful a sleep that was.
My guest is Miles O'Brien, the frontline correspondent on Flying Cheap, which airs tomorrow on Channel 13 here at 9 p.m. Roger Cohen, the president of the Regional Airline Association, says in your documentary, the regulations and shared responsibility that have been built over decades have given American travelers the safest system of transportation the world has ever known. And as we mentioned earlier, there have been a decrease in plane crashes over the years. But we didn't point out that but most of them or all of them involved regional carriers.
The last six fatal crashes in the U.S. involved a regional carrier. Okay, so that is something that, you know, Roger Cohen would not want to connect any dots between those events. But the last six crashes, regional airlines, is that a coincidence? I have to just ask that rhetorically at this point because we cannot say for certain. I just submit that as a fact. So the question is this. Yes, it is an extremely safe way to get there. There is no question about that. But There apparently is some kind of trend at work here. Six in a row tells me something. And you have to ask yourself, what is next? Is this a trend that will continue? And is this something that needs to be addressed at a governmental level? Does the industry really need to reevaluate the way it operates and relates to these small carriers? There's a saying in aviation that the absence of accidents does not necessarily mean you're safe, because accidents are always a series of little missteps along the way. And if you pull any one of those little mistakes out, usually there's no accident. The question is, in the case of Buffalo, all those missteps lined up and gave us a terrible, fatal calamity. Are there other potential accidents that are nearly happening? And is there another Buffalo in the work right now? We just need to ask that question. And remember, yes, it's a safe way to go, but is it as safe as we think it is?
Now, didn't the FAA change its policies and instead of doing investigations, just have the airlines check into their own safety policies?
Well, the FAA is, you know, completely overwhelmed, frankly. You know, this is in our nation, we have in excess of 30,000 departures every day. 30,000 departures is a lot when you consider there are less than 4,000 inspectors on the FAA. So they have to rely on a cooperative arrangement with the airlines in order to police them. You know, you have to be a bit of the good cop to make this work. You have to make it possible for the airlines to come forward and say, hey, look, we've got a problem here, to self-report. It is ultimately in their interest, after all. Where the concern comes in is in this this atmosphere of cooperation can go over the line and lead to, frankly, too cozy a relationship, and it has happened in the past.
A listener wants to know if there are major carriers that use these regional airlines less than others.
Well, you know, it certainly, if you look at, say, Southwest's business model is not really a hub and spoke model. They don't have a regional network that feeds Southwest. So they're kind of a different operation. But all the legacy carriers, one way or another, have a regional feeder, one way or another. And in some cases, like in the case of American, they own American Eagle. So that's a little different than just an airline that hires a Colgan to do its business and doesn't ask too many questions about how it does business. So it's important for people to take a look at that ticket, look at who is really operating that flight, do a little bit of homework on that particular airline, not the legacy carrier whose logo is on there, but the one who it says at the bottom, operated by. Check that one out as well.
Is JetBlue called a legacy carrier?
No, JetBlue would be of the Southwest kind of model. JetBlue is not really the classic hub and spoke type of operation. They are a low-cost airline that flies point-to-point along the lines of Southwest. So it's a little different operation. They don't feed a hub the way the other airlines have chosen to go post-deregulation.
We have very little time, but a listener wants to know why the large carriers aren't liable for these accidents that occur on planes that bear their logos.
It's all about the contracts they write with these regional carriers and the contracts that held up in court. It's something that when you look at it, it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense, does it? But that's the way those contracts are written.
And someone in your documentary says that Continental Flight 3407 was a watershed in the airline industry. So do you expect to see changes?
I hope so. You know, in talking to the FAA and Randy Babbitt, he is cognizant of this issue, but there's a lot of players in the game here who don't want to see things change. The fact of the matter is, if those minimum
we have to leave it there. I'm so
okay.
Sorry, Miles. Miles,
that's all right.
O'Brien is the frontline correspondent on Flying Cheap, which airs tomorrow at 9 p.m. on PBS stations around the country. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.